For Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, Pakistan's president walks a fine line at the UN, calling for enlightened moderation throughout the Islamic world, mindful he's a marked man at home.
The second U.S. military spy case has officials rethinking security.
And the U.S.-appointed governing council in Iraq imposes a two-week ban on two Arab TV stations for inciting violence.
Does not bode well for how the governing council will treat media, especially when they are dealing with sensitive issues. But we hope that that will change, certainly.
Also, criticism of Canadian mail order drugs heats up the issue of American drug deliveries.
These stories and coming back to Las Vegas, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. There's been another attack in Iraq, this time on a movie theater. A hand grenade exploded in the theater in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. Police say two people were killed, at least seven others were wounded. A witness told police the movie being shown at the time of the blast was pornographic. Islamic militants have been known to attack some cinemas in post-war Iraq that show movies they consider immoral. President Bush has had some success in his push to win support for U.N. involvement in rebuilding Iraq. Germany opposed the war in Iraq, but today Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder agreed to set aside past differences and work together to stabilize the country. President Bush told reporters how he did it.
The first thing I told him, I said, look, we've had differences and they're over, and we're going to work together. And I believe when Germany and America works together, we can accomplish a lot of positive things. We're both committed to freedom. We're both committed to peace.
France has insisted on what it calls a realistic timetable for returning sovereignty to the Iraqi people and an immediate end to the U.S. military occupation. Today, it's Schroeder's turn to address the United Nations General Assembly. Yesterday, President Bush spoke to the U.N. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is on Capitol Hill defending the Bush administration's $87 billion request for Iraq and Afghanistan. In testimony before the Senate Appropriations Committee, Rumsfeld said the money is needed to provide stability around the world. At the same time, the top U.S. administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, appeared before the Foreign Relations Committee and also called on lawmakers to support the request.
We cannot simply pat the Iraqis on the back, tell them they're lucky to be rid of Saddam, and then ask them to go find their place in a global marketplace. To do so would invite economic collapse followed by political extremism.
Democrats have challenged both Rumsfeld and Bremer on the need to rebuild Iraq. Police in Britain and Colombia say they've broken up a major drug cartel through coordinated raids carried out today. There were numerous arrests and seizures of large amounts of money. From London, Suzanne Chislett reports.
The joint operation between British and Colombian forces is the culmination of a two-year program to find and detain the leaders of a major drug ring. It's thought the gang was the largest smuggler of cocaine into Britain. Police in London raided 23 separate addresses, arresting an undisclosed number of suspects, the majority of whom are known to be Colombian nationals. British detectives have already made 20 arrests and seized more than $32 million worth of cocaine. Police targeted the gang through a money laundering operation, which they say was run on a huge scale. They revealed two individuals alone had put $28 million through one premises in a year-long period. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Chislett in London.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 63 points to 95.13 in moderate trade. The Nasdaq is down 20 points to 1881. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, three major paper products manufacturers have agreed to an out-of-court settlement in a class-action lawsuit brought by customers. The companies, International Paper, Weyerhaeuser, and Georgia-Pacific, all have agreed to pay a total of $68 million to settle claims they conspired to hike prices of containerboard between the years 1993 and 1995. The court must approve the settlement. The companies admit no wrongdoing but decided to settle, they say, to avoid additional costs of going to court. California is cracking down on spam. The state's new ban on junk email is the toughest such law in the nation. From member station KCRW, Eric Roy reports.
A law just signed by California Governor Gray Davis bars internet advertisers from sending unsolicited emails and carries fines of up to $1 million per incident. By comparison, a Washington state anti-spam law includes civil penalties of $500 per message. The California law targets firms that send unwanted email and the companies whose products or services are advertised. It lets the state attorney general go after spammers anywhere in the United States or elsewhere by seizing bank accounts and other financial assets of out-of-state companies that spam California residents or businesses. The marketing firm Ferris Research says junk email cost U.S. businesses nearly $9 billion in 2002. The spam ban goes into effect January 1st. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
Scholastic is still losing money, but is in better shape in the latest quarter than it was this time last year, thanks in large part to the latest Harry Potter book. The children's book publisher and distributor says its loss shrunk to $24.8 million, compared to more than $44 million a year earlier. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine, FFR, presents new thinking about balancing the demands of jobs and family life on the web at fordfound.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf is walking a razor's edge today at the UN, speaking before the General Assembly as a key ally of the United States, who at the same time leads an Islamic country where a majority fiercely opposed the war in Iraq and where elements in his own military and intelligence services still allegedly support al-Qaeda and the Taliban. In his UN speech, Musharraf calls for enlightened moderation throughout the Islamic world. Before the speech, he met with President George Bush to discuss the always complex but never more critical state of U.S.-Pakistani relations and to discuss the UN speech. We're joined now by Anwar Iqbal. He's a South Asian analyst for United Press International. He joins us from New York, and welcome, Anwar.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Anwar. Musharraf walked such delicate lines, six attempts on his life since he took office. The U.S. badly wants Pakistani troops and Islamic presence in Iraq. How did the meeting with President Bush go?
Well, I spoke with a Pakistani official who was there in the meeting, and he said that it was cordial and friendly and that the large portion of it was occupied by talks on Iraq.
Will there be any Pakistani movement towards sending troops to Iraq? Any indications?
Let's put it this way. There is a willingness. They do want to, because Musharraf, it's not just that they want to help the United States, but Musharraf, the way he has aligned himself with the United States in Afghanistan and in Iraq, that means he has made a lot of enemies in Pakistan, and now it's too late for him to disassociate with the United States and go on his own way. So he does want to help, but he's also afraid of annoying even further religious groups inside Pakistan. Also, it's not a very popular cause in Pakistan. So he is treading a very fine line. And I think the Americans also realize this. That's what Pakistan officials have been saying, at least. And they do want him to commit troops, but in a way that does not destabilize Musharraf in Pakistan, because that again will create a difficult situation for America as well, because Americans want him to stay in power in Pakistan too.
What did you make of the speech at the UN? He called for enlightened moderation, a new term from Pervez Musharraf?
Yes, a new term, but also last year, since last year, he has been urging people in Pakistan not to be silent listeners, as he says, he uses this term, when they hear extremists and fundamentalists talking about things that they do not agree with, that should not sit quietly and listen to Friday's sermons in the mosque. They should, that whenever somebody tries to sort of interpret jihad as war or talks about, you know, fighting against the infidels or whatever, they should stop them. And that actually, there is another very significant thing that he and Pakistan is working on, which is he's called it reviving or revitalizing the Organization of Islamic Conference. And the Pakistanis have made a big plan. They have sent their foreign minister around discussing it with other Muslim countries. And they want the OIC, which is an organization representing 56 Muslim countries, to take a strong stand on this and to fight against fundamentalism.
Anwar Iqbal, thanks very much for joining us, South Asian analyst for United Press International.
Syrian officials are denying any connection to the American Air Force translator of Syrian descent who's been charged with espionage. Ahmed Al-Hawapi, an interpreter at the military base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is facing 32 charges, ranging from passing prisoner messages to Syrian agents to unlawfully delivering baklava. His is the second espionage arrest connected to the base at Guantanamo Bay. The first, Muslim chaplain James Yee, has not yet been charged. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Eric Schmidt, military correspondent for The New York Times. Hello, Eric.
Hi, Robin. How are you today?
Fine. Well, can you briefly summarize for us the charges against Air Force translator Al-Hawapi? Some of them could bring the death penalty.
The most serious charges are those of espionage. That is, that the 24-year-old airman, who was a logistics specialist, basically passed military secrets to agents of the Syrian government. These include prison maps, cell block information, the names of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, and messages from them, both handwritten messages and electronic messages that he copied down from them. So it's a wide range of very serious charges that also include transferring classified information from classified computers onto an unclassified laptop.
This is very serious business, but it also raises the question, baklava?
Well, exactly. I mean, the military has a history of kind of piling on in these kind of cases where they'll add more charges than they really believe will ever be needed.
On the other hand, we were thinking that bringing food to prisoners anywhere probably isn't a good idea because you could potentially poison someone, for instance.
Well, that's possible. I mean, what he's charged with is basically violating the orders of the base commander that you shouldn't give food or communicate in certain ways with the prisoners that are at the camp. But as a translator, he obviously had contact with many people in the camp, both prisoners as well as, I was told by Pentagon officials, perhaps Captain Yee.
Al-Hawapi's friends have been giving some reasons why he might have done some of these things. What are those reasons?
Well, they say that he is not any kind of a political operative or anything like that. He's somebody who has, as you mentioned, is of Syrian descent, who has visited Syria once or twice and was looking to travel back there. From what some sources say, to pick up his fiance in the country. So he was communicating with the Syrian government just a means of getting ready for a trip over there. And so his supporters, his lawyers, his military lawyers are characterizing many of these contacts as quite innocuous.
The Muslim chaplain you mentioned, James Yee, is not mentioned in any of the charges against Al-Hawapi. But as you also mentioned, people are feeling they might have known each other. What is the military thinking in light of these two arrests in regards to security?
Well, clearly there's concern at the camp. I mean, this is one of the highest security camps that the United States government runs right now. And the officials at Guantanamo Bay that I talked to last night seem to be kind of shaken, and we're going over their security procedures, pretty thoroughly after this one.
This has just come to light now, but in fact this arrest took place a while ago. What has happened within the military? How shaken up is it, and how maybe divided is it because of the arrests?
Well, it's hard to tell because this was kept secret essentially until yesterday. The translator's arrest was first broken by CNN yesterday. He was arrested on July 23rd in Jacksonville, Florida. It was only when his case began working its way through the military justice system last week that people had an inkling, I think, of what was going on. His lawyers formally petitioned the court to open the proceedings in his case. The military had sought to have them closed, and I think that got some attention.
And is anyone in the military saying what some civilians are saying on talk radio, for instance, no Muslims in the military?
I think that would be a gross overreaction to this case.
But in other words, you're not hearing that from the military either?
No. Yeah. No, I think, what has to be looked at are some of the concerns about how you vet some of the individuals who work at the camp and who have close relations or proximity to the prisoners who may be Muslims. But I think, you know, to go out and suddenly engage in kind of an overall, almost a witch hunt, the Muslims in the military would be inappropriate at this time.
Eric, thank you.
You're welcome.
Eric Schmidt, military correspondent for The New York Times, spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
One ambition of the United States in Iraq has already to a great extent succeeded, creating a much more free press. Under Saddam Hussein, only a handful of state-controlled newspapers existed. Dozens now daily report and critique the present situation. But now, two Arab satellite television networks have been banned for 2 weeks from covering the U.S.-installed Iraqi Governing Council. Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya are accused of inciting violence against the U.S. occupation and its supporters. To learn more about this, we're joined now by Joel Campagna, Middle East Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. And welcome, Joel.
Thank you.
Joel, the Iraqi Governing Council was appointed by the U.S., of course. Does that mean this ban is in effect by U.S. authorities?
Well, to our knowledge, the Coalition Provisional Authority has not commented, but we've had spokespersons for the Iraqi Governing Council talk about the reasons for the bans, and as we know, it is a U.S.-appointed council. But to date, we have not heard any comment yet from the U.S. authorities.
So what are the reasons for the ban?
Depending on the spokesperson that you hear it from, they range from the alleged incitement to violence that these two stations have carried out.
What sort of thing? You mean reporters actually going on the air and inciting people to attack U.S. troops?
Well, that's what's troubling about the statements. There was not specified what reports in particular led to the ban or which constitute the incitement. Hmm. But one spokesman for Ahmed Shalabi, who is a member of the Governing Council, said that some of their broadcasts had comments from militants calling for the death of members of the Governing Council, and that in general they had incited violence.
Yet in CNN or any other international outlet, for example, you'll see members of Hamas from time to time condemning Israel and threatening to kill Israelis?
Sure, and I think that's what's so troubling about these sanctions is that we have very vague charges that could be applied to seemingly just about any news report, including those that have been done by Western news organizations. And, you know, I think the authorities can have their opinions and express their views about news coverage, but certainly the answer is not sanctioning journalists and preventing them from doing their jobs.
What's been the reaction, so far as you know, of Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya?
They have certainly expressed their concerns about the restrictions, and as of yesterday at least, had said they had not received the formal order from the Governing Council in Iraq. So to them, they had heard about it only secondhand.
What do you think is going to happen here? Is this, you seem to be suggesting that this may be a harbinger of things to come, an unwillingness to allow too much open display of hostility toward the Governing Council?
Well, I think it raises serious questions about how the Iraqi authorities will handle the broadcast or publication of negative news. Certainly, this is the first instance we've had of the Governing Council taking such an action against the press. And if we look at the situation going into Iraq, there was a lot of hope that the press there, which got off to a very positive start, the explosion of independent newspapers and new media, and there was a sense that it would offer a very stark and positive contrast to other countries in the region where media are censored and harried by local authorities there. And I don't think that, at least for starters, this does not bode well for how the Governing Council will treat media, especially when they are dealing with sensitive issues. But we hope that that will change, certainly.
Joel Campagna, Middle East Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
Just ahead, the FDA is warning American consumers of unsafe prescription drugs coming in from Canada. But is it overlooking the safety of drugs shipped domestically?
And later in the show, the president attacks the international sex trade.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A new posting on the Food and Drug Administration website warns consumers about the dangers of purchasing mail-order drugs from Canada. It is illegal, but the agency warns the drugs could also be outdated, contaminated, counterfeit, or they may have been subjected to inappropriate heat or cold. Well, some critics of the FDA are wondering, what about legal mail-order drugs within the U.S.? A recent test found 1 in 4 mail-order prescription drug deliveries within the U.S. were exposed to excessive heat, which could severely diminish, say, insulin. Joining us on the line to talk about the issue is, first, the FDA's Associate Commissioner for Policy and Planning, Bill Hubbard. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm just fine. Your website uses some very strong language when it comes to these Canadian drugs. Again, they may be counterfeit or outdated. But besides that one shipment of insulin that wasn't refrigerated in Springfield, Massachusetts, besides that one sting, is there evidence of any major problems with drugs coming in from Canada?
Unfortunately, there is. We have surveyed the mails that come in from Canada that contain prescription drugs and found a number of cases of problematic drugs.
Can you give us an example? Because, you know, those who take some drugs might be especially interested.
Well, for instance, we've seen drugs that whose expiration date has passed. We have seen drugs that were supposed to be refrigerated and were not. We've even seen counterfeit drugs. Some of the websites that allege they're in Canada apparently aren't even in Canada. So the consumer who goes on the Internet and sees a promise of American-made, Canadian-regulated drugs may be getting something far different from what he's told.
Well, as you know, some people see these drugs as a lifeline, a way of saving between 50% and 80% of the cost of their name-brand prescription drugs. And they also question whether or not the FDA is being equally tough on U.S. mail-order deliveries. The study I mentioned came from U.S. Pharmacopeia, which, as you know, is the group charged by your agency with setting standards. We're going to be speaking to a representative in a moment. But their study was pretty disturbing. Not only did they find 1 in 4 U.S. mailings exposed to excessive heat, but mailboxes, for instance, can be as much as 136 degrees. So do you do the same sting in the U.S.?
Mail order, it does put drugs at some risk. As I understand it, most American pharmacies that mail attempt to put in co-packs, for instance, for refrigerated drugs. However, there will be an effort with USP to set more specific standards for mail order.
Well, USP has said that, in fact, they've tried to, for instance, suggest temperature sensors, but that's been turned down repeatedly.
But that is something now that is being studied.
In other words, you'd be open to that?
Absolutely.
What do you think of the thinking? And you've heard it, I know, that your agency is going after Canadian drugs because you've been charged also with protecting U.S. drug companies, that it's a trade issue.
So FDA was told by Congress over 60 years ago to make drugs safe. And we believe that the system that's evolved gives us the safest drug system in the world between the federal regulation and then the state regulation of the pharmacies themselves. And these foreign imports undermine that. Clearly, drug prices are very high, and people who cannot afford their drug tell us that it's better to take that risk from a foreign drug if they cannot afford it in the United States. So it's a very difficult public policy issue here.
Do you think there's any chance ever that Canadian drugs and the mailings of Canadian drugs to the U.S. would be made legal?
Well, certainly Congress is considering that. And obviously, if Congress steps in and says, we want to let those drugs in, FDA will do its best to regulate them in a safe way. Right now, the congressional mandate is to keep those drugs out.
Thank you, sir.
You're certainly welcome.
Bill Hubbard is the Associate Commissioner for Policy and Planning at the FDA in Washington, D.C. Eric Scheinen is the Vice President of Standards for U.S. Pharmacopeia in Rockville, Maryland. We turn now to you, Eric. Your thoughts on what you just heard from Mr. Hubbard.
Well, Robin, I heard Bill Hubbard say that FDA would be very happy to work with USP in helping to develop standards related both to time sensors in products that are shipped by mail order, as well as the whole mail order picture. And I think that's really very encouraging. USP is a private standard-setting organization that sets standards for drugs and provides other information and guidance. So it's very critical for us to be able to work closely with the FDA.
Do you also find it just a little surprising, given that until very recently, your group was pushing for the sensors and to no avail?
From what I recall, a number of years ago, the sensors were built in with other approaches that USP was proposing, and the way that was presented in the past was not really acceptable to FDA or to the industry. Mm. Temperature sensors by themselves will be a different story.
It seems like such a simple idea. Why was there resistance to it?
Anything that involves additional work by the industry is going to conceivably create a venue where you might have increased prices because of the additional cost. And when you're talking about the pharmaceutical industry in the U.S., this is a tremendous industry in terms of the number of prescriptions that are filled every year. So even a small cost for any one prescription adds up quite rapidly.
You've proposed these national guidelines, and I keep bringing up the sensors, but that's the one that comes to mind. You've proposed them in the past. They've been defeated in the past. Now there seems to be, as you just heard, a change. There might be some consideration of them. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's the publicity that you and Bill Hubbard talked about, the information that's coming out. I think it would be related to the tremendous increase in the mail-order prescription business.
And what essentially do you think is the difference between mail orders within the U.S. and mail orders from Canada? Do you think there is as drastic a difference as the FDA does?
Something coming from out of the country, you don't know how it's been stored. You don't know where it's been. It's the unknown, I think, that is the key factor there. So I don't think you have the same concerns and fears for materials that are shipped within the United States.
Well, Eric, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Eric Scheinen is Vice President of Standards for U.S. Pharmacopeia in Rockville, Maryland. And we also spoke to Bill Hubbard, Associate Commissioner for Policy and Planning at the FDA in Washington.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, China wants to put a man in space this fall, possibly early next month. Is the U.S.-China space race far behind?
And our Latin music reviewer raves about pianist Michel Camilo's new offering. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Bush swings the spotlight on a huge problem, sex trafficking.
We can safely say that almost every single country in the world is affected by trafficking in one way or the other.
New studies show capital punishment deters crime.
And Las Vegas switches tactics.
Vegas was not really intended in its roots to become a city for families. I think that from day one, it was always a place for people to go to escape their family and to escape their work and their lifestyle that they had.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. President Bush continues his campaign to win the support of other member nations of the UN for U.S. policy in Iraq. Today he won a commitment from German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder to set aside their differences over Iraq. Mark Smith reports.
The meeting at Bush's hotel was the first since their angry clash over the Iraq war, with the German side accusing Bush of warmongering and the U.S. side saying Gerhard Schroeder played the anti-American card to win re-election. Both leaders say that's all behind them now.
I said, look, we've had differences, and they're over.
We have both agreed that we want to look into the future together.
Schroeder, speaking through an interpreter, said Germany's ready to help in post-war Iraq by training security forces, since he says a stable Iraq is in Europe's interest, too. However, officials say a UN vote to authorize such contributions is still a ways off, with differences remaining on when power can be handed back to Iraqis. Mark Smith with the President, New York.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is urging Congress to move quickly on the request for $87 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. Testifying before the Senate Appropriations Committee, Rumsfeld was asked by Senator Robert Byrd whether the American people support such an expense.
Where is the mandate for that? The American people have never been told that.
Well, the last thought I could suggest is this, that the task we're engaged in, the bulk of the funds here, are for the purpose of providing security and to enable the political process to move forward so that sovereignty can be transferred to the Iraqi people.
Rumsfeld says it sends a message to terrorists that the U.S. does not value money more than its freedom. A federal judge has ruled that the Federal Trade Commission overstepped its authority in creating the national Do Not Call list. The ruling came in a lawsuit brought by telemarketers who challenged the creation of a list of 50 million people who say they don't want to receive business solicitation calls. Candidates hoping to replace California Governor Gray Davis are moving forward now that court challenges to the state's October 7th recall vote have apparently ended. A federal appeals court panel reinstated the original election timetable yesterday. Tonight is the only nationally televised debate in which front-runner actor Arnold Schwarzenegger is scheduled to appear. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 90 points at 94.85, the Nasdaq behind 32 at 18.69. You are listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
When President Bush addressed the United Nations yesterday, he chose to highlight three main issues: terrorism, weapons proliferation, and human trafficking.
There's a special evil in the abuse and exploitation of the most innocent and vulnerable. The victims of sex trade see little of life before they see the very worst of life, an underground of brutality and lonely fear. Those who create these victims and profit from their suffering must be severely punished.
According to administration officials in today's New York Times, the decision to include the illegal sex industry in the president's speech was intended to put a softer face on U.S. foreign policy. The president's call for new measures to stop human trafficking included few specifics and no announcement of new funding. We're joined now by Michelle Clark. She's co-director of the Protection Project. That's a human rights research institute at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome, Michelle.
It's nice to be with you.
And Michelle, your reaction to this aspect of the president's speech?
I was very pleased. It was a great statement for us.
Were you surprised?
A little bit. As many initially, we wondered why in this particular speech, but then very quickly we decided, well, why not? It was a good time. It was a good audience. And it created a lot of visibility for our issue.
Well, we'll get to some of the other speculation about the whys in a moment, but first, tell us about this issue. How big a problem is human trafficking?
The problem of human trafficking has escalated rapidly over the past 10 years, and we can safely say that almost every single country in the world is affected by trafficking in one way or the other. The conservative estimates quoted by the president in his speech are that between 800,000 and 900,000 women and children a year are trafficked across international borders.
And we're talking about children, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds?
We're talking about children that young, and we're talking about women who are forced into lives of bondage and slavery. The president limited his remarks pretty much to trafficking for sexual exploitation. Trafficking for forced labor also exists.
Yeah, and what would you like to see done?
First of all, I want to see more and more attention called to this issue, and I think that that was one thing accomplished by this forum. There are large segments of our own country and countries around the world where people have not yet acknowledged that this goes on in their own backyards.
Mm. Well, and as you know, there are some who are saying that President Bush just used this mention in a speech to woo countries who are more worried about social concerns, such as this one. And with that in mind, less than a year ago, the president gave a major speech in which he talked about terrorism, Iraq, and at that time, AIDS. AIDS groups were also thrilled, but then there was a promise of $15 billion, not all of which has even been delivered. Yesterday, there wasn't even a promise of new money for groups like yours. So are you worried that this might have just been a political moment?
I'm not, and I'm not at all. I think that politically, the U.S. government has taken some very courageous steps. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act, mentioned by the president, was a real landmark piece of human rights legislation, which declares that these women and children are, in fact, victims of a violent crime and deserve to be treated with great compassion. Our own legislation in the United States reflects these policies. I think now the ball is really in the courts of the activists, the service providers, the normal citizens to really rise up vocally to attack this issue in their own particular communities.
Michelle, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Michelle Clark, co-director of the Protection Project at Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C.
Increasingly, in recent years, the death penalty has been under fire. In more than 100 cases using DNA, convicted criminals on death row have been found innocent. Still, in Massachusetts, Governor Mitt Romney wants to reinstitute the death penalty and is pressing for a law that is foolproof.
This will be a new kind of death penalty bill that we intend to fashion, one that puts science above all other considerations, ahead of eyewitness testimony, ahead of confessions. Just as science can free the innocent, science can identify the guilty.
Also in Republican Romney's favor are new studies that show the death penalty does deter crime. Joining us in the studio now is Edward Schwartz, visiting professor at the Boston University School of Law, who teaches about capital punishment. And Ed, previous studies had shown that the death penalty didn't deter crime. Has something changed?
Well, a few things have changed, and I think perhaps the most significant thing that has changed is that there has been a greater effort to collect more systematic and extensive data, and frankly, the development of more powerful computers has really facilitated this kind of analysis.
And what does the analysis show?
Well, there have now...
There's an Emory University study, I guess.
Correct, but that's actually only one of several that have come out in the last few years, and they seem to all show that there is a deterrent effect from capital punishment. Now, interestingly enough, it's not whether the state has capital punishment on the books that seems to matter, or even the frequency with which juries give out capital sentences. What seems to matter is whether or not the state actually goes through and executes people.
Now, what could the impact be around the country? We're speaking in Massachusetts, where Governor Mitt Romney, the Republican governor, is now pushing for the death penalty in this state. Could that be a phenomenon elsewhere?
I think so. I mean, we have had some reintroduction of the death penalty. For instance, New York is probably the example with which people around here are most familiar. And, of course, there's a fairly widely publicized push by the current federal administration, Bush and Ashcroft, to actually seek the death penalty more frequently in those cases in which it might be available.
Ed, federal prosecutors in Boston have asked U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft to consider filing a death penalty charge against Charles Jaynes, who's one of two men convicted in a terrible 1997 kidnapping and murder of a 10-year-old boy, Jeffrey Curley. What's the significance of that?
I think, if anything, it's a signaling on the part of the administration that they're serious about this. It seems to me
what's particularly interesting about this, too, is that Jaynes is already serving a life sentence, and now they're intervening to possibly give him the death penalty.
That's correct. It strikes me as a somewhat odd push in light of the fact that the person is already behind bars for the crime. So the entire cost of this enterprise has to be compared with whatever we believe to be the marginal deterrent effect of having Mr. Jaynes executed as opposed to behind bars essentially for the rest of his life.
Still somewhat ironic, is it not, to be talking about expanding death penalty possibilities at a time when we've had so much publicity about cases using DNA evidence where people convicted of a crime were found to be innocent?
Actually, the DNA evidence development can cut in both directions. If one were to make DNA matching a regular part of these investigations and cases, then you might argue that the likelihood of error in these cases is going to drop precipitously, and therefore it's not quite as dangerous to pursue the death penalty because you'll make fewer mistakes.
Hmm. Edward Schwartz, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Edward Schwartz, visiting professor at the Boston University School of Law, teaches about capital punishment.
You're listening to Here and Now.
In Hartford, the Wolfpack.
Here we go.
And behind the play, Sasha Lakovic and Darren Langdon.
Sports fans are about to segue seamlessly from baseball season to hockey, but the hockey teams may have a harder time. The National Hockey League 2003 season gets underway next month, but last year the NHL had operating losses of $300 million, TV ratings were down, franchise values were down, and two teams are in bankruptcy court. On the line is Professor of Economics Andrew Zimbalist of Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. And Professor Zimbalist, first of all, why is the league in so much trouble?
There are a few reasons, but I think the biggest problem right now is the national television contract. They're just not generating the big dollars like the other major team sports are. And in all probability, when the present contract expires after next year, it will diminish, so the situation will get even worse.
In other words, the networks aren't paying as much for the privilege of airing the games because fewer people are watching?
That's right. I mean, you're looking at $4 or $5 million per team in hockey. Contrast that with the NFL, where they're getting over $80 million per team. So that's the major problem, and that problem is connected to another one, which is that the national television contract is money that's divided equally across the teams. Because it's so small in hockey, there's very little equalization of revenue. And you've got some franchises with $120 million in hockey and other franchises with $40 million in hockey. It's quite clear that hockey needs a revenue-sharing system. It does not presently have one. Until it has one, there will be teams on the bottom that are losing money.
Right. Tell me about salaries.
Well, salaries have actually grown more rapidly than revenues in the NHL. They're up at around an average of $1.8 million for this coming year. And they're probably going to be somewhere in the order of 60% to 70% of revenues. The tricky thing here, and it's tricky also in the figures that you cited at the outset, is that the hockey teams don't report all of the revenue they generate as hockey revenue. Sometimes they'll shuffle the money over to the arena that they own, or they'll shuffle it over to a television station that they own.
Well, it sounds like there's even a bigger problem than this, Professor. You're talking about the internal business and the salaries, and that seems to be a standard conversation now in sports. But why is it that no one cares? I mean, you're talking about the TV ratings plummeting, and in many places we read television audience ratings are higher for bowling than for hockey.
Yeah. Well, it's a major problem. Look, I mean, what's going on in the world right now is there's a telecommunications revolution, and there is a proliferation of cable channels or satellite channels that people can choose amongst, and some of those channels are carrying niche sports. So the audience is being increasingly fragmented. Now, hockey has never had particularly high television ratings, and I think part of the problem is the nature of the game. It's you're looking at a very, very small puck that moves at remarkable speeds. It's simply a hard game to watch on television. Great game to watch in person, but not so great on TV.
Well, we're going to hear now from both bowling and hockey fans who love the game, but is it possible that they just need another Gretzky, another Orr?
Well, it would certainly help if they had a charismatic superstar come along. I mean, perhaps part of the problem in the United States and Canada is that today they have about 30% of the players are coming from the other side of the Atlantic, and it might be more difficult for North American fans to relate to those. But certainly it would not help. It would not hurt them to have a superstar come along. I don't, however, think it would solve the major issues.
Well, Professor Zimbalist, thanks so much. And I guess, you know, watch a hockey game now while you can.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Andrew Zimbalist spoke to us from Smith College in Massachusetts.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
For those of you a little slow with the TV remote, you might have noticed some new commercials for Las Vegas recently. The slogan is, "What happens here stays here." Get it? Not too subtle. Well, WBUR's Sean Carberry spent a weekend getting to the bottom of the new pitch.
Airport?
Yes.
Well, my name is Jim.
I just love the smell of your limo, Jim.
Oh, yeah? Well, it's a new car.
I love the new Crystal.
Yeah, I wish it was mine.
It smells so good, Jim. It's leather.
But when she arrives at the airport and exits the limo, she's transformed, prim and proper, ready to return to her quiet life and leave behind all traces of the hedonist she was during her time in Las Vegas. This ad is a far cry from the family-friendly image Vegas was exporting in the 90s, when the city tried to compete with Disneyland and SeaWorld for tourist dollars. By the end of the 90s, Mayor Oscar Goodman saw the writing on the wall.
We really have to have an adult theme, that the family brand really wasn't what brings the high rollers, people we call the whales, in here. The folks that we wanted to bring into Las Vegas were the people who were looking for excitement, for fun. And that means adult fun.
The new campaign is designed to appeal to those high rollers and catch the whales.
The ads that we that were first composed and approved by the Convention Authority were those that showed that people who could come to Las Vegas were free. They could leave their cares and woes behind and come here and have a good time. Then we graduated ourselves, stepped up to a more sensual presentation, and those are the ads of what goes on here stays here, and I think they're pretty neat myself.
The mayor cracks a smile as he describes the current ad campaign, and he's not the only one in the city grinning. Revenues are up, and throughout the city, casino owners and developers are racing to create new attractions that cater to younger, more financially endowed visitors looking to leave the kids at home and cut loose. Zoomanity, the latest offering from Cirque du Soleil, is an example of the new adult theme. The show adds an erotic element to the traditional Cirque approach, exploring sexuality and the sensual aspects of being human. It begins with four Puritans cautioning the audience.
Do you really want to be aroused in a
public place? If you choose to stay, beware the stirrings of lust in your nether regions.
First taste.
Pat from Delaware wasn't turned off by the show's raciness.
We read that, like, some of their clothes were painted on, but didn't really know much about it at all before we got here. But it was great. It was like a little Rocky Horror thrown in with, you know, burlesque. It was wonderful. It was very arousing, actually. Wish my husband was here. He's not.
Who knows what adventures she'll find during the rest of her stay in the city, but her secrets are safe in Vegas. And that's the way Mayor Goodman wants it.
You come here, nobody's looking over your shoulder. You have a good time. You go to the edge. Don't fall over, because you'll get in trouble if you fall over. But if you go to the edge, you can do anything that's legal. And don't worry about anybody telling on you. And then when you go back home, you go back to your humdrum regular existence. And you remember you had a great time in Vegas.
Another place to get wild in Vegas is in one of the myriad new nightclubs. The hotels are trying to keep guests in-house with exotic lounges where patrons can be as wild as they choose. There's the hedonistic Studio 54 at the MGM Grand, the sultry Ghost Bar at the Palms, and Taboo.
Taboo is the extreme in all forms of indulgence.
General Manager Candace Carroll extols the virtues of her club.
You have the most beautiful room. You have the most beautiful sounds. You have the most wonderful tasting drinks. We have a great specialty cocktail menu.
That's important because Vegas was not really intended in its roots to become a city for families.
I think that from day one, it was always a place for people to go to escape their family and to escape their work and their lifestyle that they have. This is where they go to leave all those troubles behind, come in.
I approached several patrons in hopes of getting their take on Taboo. But each person I asked reacted as if they had just been caught doing something they didn't want anyone to know about. Finally, I found one woman waiting in line who did want to speak to me. She is a native of Las Vegas, and she was the first voice of skepticism I encountered. Miranda, not her real name, doesn't buy the new ad campaign or the fantasies it's selling.
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's over-exaggerated. I think it's bad for the whole family atmosphere. I think they're going to lose a lot of business. And I think Treasure Island, for an example, is going to lose a lot of business, a lot of loyal customers trying to be someone they aren't.
Treasure Island, the pirate-themed casino, is in the midst of a major overhaul. Once a haven for families with its swashbuckling theme and giant pirate battle attraction, the decor is taking on a more mature tone. And the new outside attraction, the Sirens of TI, will open this October, featuring more adult-oriented content. But hotel president Scott Sabella isn't worried at all about losing family business.
When we opened, we were successful with the pirate show and with the theming of the property, but we knew if we wanted to continue our success, we'd have to take it to another level. The perception has always been at TI is that it's a place for kids. Our goal is to let people know that they can put TI on the radar screen if they're coming here without their kids. So we think it's going to attract a different quality of customer.
So, as far as the casino owners and Mayor Goodman are concerned, come to Vegas, have fun, spend a few paychecks, and go home with fond memories, perhaps a few secrets, and a secure alibi. As for the future of the city,
I think we'll see a real thought process as to whether or not the hotels are going to want to have racier, if there is such a word, racier venues under their own roof. Everything is heading towards whatever is legal goes here in Las Vegas.
And whatever goes on there stays there.
WBUR's Sean Carberry, whose secrets are safe in Las Vegas.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to hear from our Latin music reviewer, Jose Masso, about a new CD from Michel Camilo, a jazz pianist with classical roots. Here's a sneak preview.
He sort of like goes on a limb, and he says to his trio, follow me and see where we go with this, and hopefully at the end we'll all be at the same place. And the one thing I think that distinguishes Michel above and beyond the fact that he plays, yes, with passion and energy and speed, is joy. And you see that live. You see the joy that he brings. It's like the first time he's ever played in front of a live audience. And so you find this live album captures that joy that he performs on stage like we saw when he was in Tanglewood. And I think that's why people fall in love with him so easily.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Ann Stevenson and Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters at here-now.org. That's letters at here, here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
You can also send us mail the old-fashioned way. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
And please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name, where you're from.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
China wants to put a man in space next week. Could a U.S.-China space race be far behind?
And our Latin music reviewer with a sampling of jazz pianist Michel Camilo.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.